If you've got something to say, why don't you say it? If you've got something to give, why don't you give it to me? Day after day, I have to say it. We're moving further from heaven and closer to the deep blue sea. 'Cause I have no secrets from you.
She's a rich girl.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the FLOC, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like, a merger of some of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
13 million. Who will give me 14? I have 14 million. Do I hear 15? 15, 16, there to you, sir.
Political power doesn't come cheap in America.
Sold for $22 million of other rollback in air quality regulations.
George Bush understands that money equals power. His campaign spent nearly $50 million this March alone. That's a record.
Next on the block, the First Amendment. Who will give me 1 million?
Just because it's a democracy doesn't mean it's free. How much is your vote worth?
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
This is a big time for America.
It's not just another election, not merely about a list of issues, even though some of those issues are huge, including the deliberate downsizing of our middle class and the deadly war of lies in Iraq. What's at stake on November 2nd is the very idea of America itself. The historic idea that we might actually build a society based on our egalitarian ideals of economic fairness, social justice, and equal opportunity for all. The moneyed elites, presently working through Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, and company, have decided that America should no longer bother pursuing egalitarianism. They are asserting a new ethic of privilege, declaring that the role of government is to take care of the good fortunes of the few and not worry about the well-being of the many. In their view, they're the top dogs and the rest of us are just a bunch of fire hydrants. Wielding their administrative blowtorches and legislative monkey wrenches, they're jerry-rigging America's rules so that money and power flow uphill, out of our neighborhoods, into their corporate suites and offshore bank accounts. They're seizing control of every decision that affects our lives, from wages to taxation, from what's in your dinner to what's in your daily news feed, from who goes to college to who goes to war. They're turning our America, our democracy, into their America of plutocracy and autocracy. As I travel around the country, I find that most people are aware that something fundamental has gone wrong, that this is not the America they thought they were born into. I recently saw an old pickup truck with a bumper sticker that asked, "Where are we going? And what am I doing in this handbasket?" People know that we're being led down some rabbit trail off of America's true path toward egalitarianism. This is Jim Hightower saying, I believe we're in another of those when in the course of human events moments that Jefferson wrote about. It's a big time for America. Time to take our country back.
My name is James, and I want to tell you how a friend of mine changed my life. After my wife passed away, I found myself spending more and more time alone. I kept up with the daily business of living, but didn't get out as much. Didn't see friends as much. That's when I met a new friend. Sassy. Let me tell you about her. First of all, she can perform miracles. She's only a year old, weighs only 9 pounds, but she can jump up 5 times her own height. But the most impressive miracle is what a difference she's made in my life. She's my cat. I named her Sassy because I had a cat named Sassy when I was a little boy. I shared everything with that cat. What I've realized is that it doesn't matter if you're 8 or 80. We all need friends. I found my best friend, Sassy, at the ASPCA.
This is Richard Thompson, member of the board of directors of the ASPCA, encouraging you to visit your local animal shelter and adopt a cat.
Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, was George Bush seeking a permission slip? Isn't that sad, that kind of rhetoric? I mean, isn't it just tragic? Anyhow, George W., just address the United Nations. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour. The beginning of the program, the top of the program here. Broadcasting live, coast to coast on radio stations from California to North Carolina. Beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system. And streaming around the planet on radiopower.org. Welcome to our program. This go-it-alone strategy, the whole right-wing, it goes beyond right-wing, this whole neocon ideology George Bush has bought into. What they miss, what they completely miss, and they do it with these cheap shots, I've never asked for a permission slip, is that participating with the UN, going to the UN, working with the United Nations, or other nations in other contexts, regional agreements, is not going to another country and saying, please give me permission, or anything like that. It's about protecting our interests and protecting our taxpayers and protecting our soldiers. We're not the only country in the world. I know the neocons want it to be that way. You know, the security strategy for the United States that they wrote a couple of years ago, and, you know, going back to the Project for a New American Century, never allow any other country to gain military supremacy over the United States. Well, our military budget is greater than the entire rest of the world combined. It's not going to happen next week. But working with the United Nations gives us, in the eyes of other countries, in a very straightforward and essential way, legitimacy and a sense of, yeah, we're all in this together. We all have a shared interest here. For example, even setting aside the United Nations, Iraq is a mess right now. I mean, this thing is going down in flames really, really bad. And it's just an absolute tragedy. People being beheaded, car bombings, our soldiers dying, and on, you know. And two of the countries on the border of Iraq, one Syria on the western border, Iran on the northeastern border, that seem to, if not be openly, well, certainly they're not openly participating in encouraging the insurrection or whatever you want to call it, the rebellion. If they're not openly supporting it, they at least have the power, a significant power, to help prevent it. By blocking people from getting in, by, you know, just the whole thing. I mean, we find out now that a bunch of the Saudis who hijacked the aircraft that ran into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the field in Pennsylvania, that they had been passing through Iran, right? I mean, you know, so here we've got Iran and Syria, who really could help us significantly with Iraq. And in Iran, the vast majority of the people love the United States. I realize that's a fact that probably most people who watch faux news are completely oblivious to, but it is a fact. There is a very, very strong pro-democracy movement inside Iran. It's being resisted by the theocrats, those who believe that a government should be founded on religion and religious principles. But nonetheless, there is a strong movement for a secular democracy. A democracy, a government of, by, and for we the people, they the people of Iran. Yeah, the mullahs can do what they want, but they can't run the government. And there just recently was, unfortunately, a step back from that. In large part because the Bush administration, by calling Iran part of the axis of evil and loudly picking on them, essentially, plain bully, has caused an increase in the power of those in Iran who say, see, they're out to get us, which is primarily the anti-democracy movement, the mullahs. You know, Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. George Bush, perhaps because the only extracurricular activity ever participated in college was at Andover. He was a cheerleader, and apparently a very good one. There's some great pictures of him with one of those megaphones, you know, and his cheerleading outfit. His philosophy has been, speak loudly and wave the stick around all you can. And, you know, time is proving Teddy Roosevelt was right. And Bush tragically is wrong on this thing. So today, George W. goes to the United Nations. This is his annual address. This isn't something that, unlike bringing the UN in to try to organize the elections and put into place the Iraqi government, the Alawi government, which was a suggestion of John Kerry's, that Bush had been ridiculing and then suddenly adopted. And the newspapers of America call it a change in policy or a recalculation or a new formula. They don't call it a flip-flop. But, you know, unlike that, this This is just Bush going before the UN. A couple of the things that I thought were really interesting. Well, let me just finish up the Iran-Syria thing. He could be working with them, even though these are regimes we don't like. Even though these are regimes that, you know, the bottom line is they are not democratic regimes. The reality is that there are strong pro-democracy movements in both Iran and in Syria. And if we were to work with these governments to try to help stabilize the situation in Iraq and make it clear to them that they're not next on the hit list, and frankly, I think in the minds of the Bush administration, they are next on the hit list, and these are going to be the first two wars we're going to see if George W. gets elected in 2004, in November this year, unfortunately, which is why he can't do this. It's why we need a new president, one of many, many good reasons. But if we were to work with these countries, then over the long term, we would be strengthening the democracy movements in their countries. They could help us stabilize the situation in Iraq. I mean, this is what we need to do in the region. Instead, we've got a president who 2 years ago, when a reporter asked him about international law, keep in mind, day before yesterday, Kofi Annan said that the United States invasion of Iraq, was a clear violation of international law. It was illegal. Well, if you commit an act which is illegal, you are a criminal. If that act involves war, you are a war criminal. Kofi Annan, for all practical purposes, said that George W. Bush was a war criminal. I didn't see a lot of hugs today, by the way. So anyhow, two years ago when Bush was asked about this, he said to a reporter, and I quote, "International law? I better call my lawyer. He didn't bring that up with me." On September 12th, 2 years ago, 2 years ago this week, or last week, he was taunting the United Nations, teasing them, poking a stick at it. Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant? Yeah, like, we take you guys real seriously. On February 13th of last year, as the Center for American Progress notes in their progress report, he says the United Nations was in danger of becoming an ineffective, irrelevant debating society. And on February 18th of last year, he questioned the United Nations' backbone and courage. So when it suits his political agenda, he slaps these folks around. And then when Iraq is going down in flames, he comes before the United Nations and goes, you know, we could use a little help. But he didn't even... He really, you know, it's funny. Yesterday, John Kerry gave this speech, and he laid out these 4 points, and one of them was to call an international summit right immediately. Right now, these guys are in New York. Let's get together with them. Let's talk. Let's make this thing happen. And the Bush administration's response was, well, we're already doing all the things Kerry's talking about. No, they're not. They lie. No, we got a great coalition. Everything's going fine. Even Great Britain is pulling its troops out. It's 6,000 troops. They're beginning to pull them out. They're taking, within 3 or 4 months, they're going to have all their combat troops out. Costa Rica, which never put any troops in to begin with because they don't have an army. When Bush was going around saying, well, we need a coalition of the billing, of the willing, you know, who's going to sign up? And they got Costa Rica to sign up so he could say that, ah, Costa Rica's a member of our coalition. Costa Rica has said, please take us off the list. John Stewart last night, he says, so the United Nations, the United States has gone from a global superpower to an annoying telemarketer. Other countries, please take us off your list. It is the failures of this administration are so conspicuous and so tragic and so destructive to the goals of democracy in the United States and around the world and stability and peace that it is breathtaking. At the same time we're going to the United Nations, we're refusing to support the things that we vote for in the United Nations. Again, as Center for American Progress notes, the Bush administration has failed to fund the UN to execute missions the United States voted to authorize. Since February, President Bush has authorized four new peacekeeping missions in Haiti, the Ivory Coast, Sudan, and Burundi through the UN Security Council. The U.S. share of these missions is estimated to be $600 million, about the amount of money we spent in Iraq in about 2 days, by the way. But the administration failed to request these funds from Congress. The failure to request funding for new operations approved by the United States undermines our credibility abroad as a reliable and trustworthy member of the Security Council. Gee, seriously. You know, yesterday, there were two UN conferences on how to deal with global poverty. You know who didn't show up? George Bush. More than 100 countries showed up, sent their leaders. Notably absent, President Bush. The United States declined to support the initiative, even though it was non-binding. We have a problem. The problem's in the White House. His name is George Bush, and he needs to be voted out on November 2nd. Tom Hartman with you, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Gesundheit. So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Are you tired of progressives spending all their energy on defensive struggles where victory simply maintains the status quo? We are too, and we're doing something about it. At ReclaimDemocracy.org, we're taking the initiative to revoke corporate power and restore citizen authority over corporations to enable genuine progress on the many issues that we all care about. Get involved. Visit us online at ReclaimDemocracy.org or call 406-582-1224.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Your election was hardly fair and square. Less than half of us put you there. Go hang out with the haves and have-nots from the middle and low. You've shut the door.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Michael Moore sends out an email saying, "Ka, stop wringing your hands." I enthusiastically, absolutely, totally agree. In fact, I would even go so far. This is for those Democrats out there who are sitting around going, "Well, John Kerry isn't the perfect candidate," and you've got to say,
"I'm a human being. My life has value."
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Now!
I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore."
Yes, thank you, Howard Beale from the Movie Network. Now, here is what is particularly upsetting. And everybody thinks, isn't it strange, the zombie polls, all these polls are showing the election a dead heat, and the Gallup poll comes in showing George Bush 11 points ahead. And, of course, it's Gallup. Gallup gets all the PR. Even though George Gallup is a Republican, is a donor to the Republican Party. Well, it turns out we now discover what happened. We now discover what happened. Although in the last election, the last three presidential elections. 34% of the people who voted were Democrats, registered. 34% of the people who voted were registered Republicans, and 33% were independents. Remember those numbers, 34, 34, 33. When the Gallup organization did their poll, September 13 through 52, they sampled a total of 767 people. 40% of them were Republicans, 33% Democrats, 28% independents. Of their registered voter poll, 38% were Republicans, 33% were Democrats, 30% independents. In other words, they're asking more Republicans than Democrats, who are you going to vote for? What a surprise that they come out with the result that it looks like Bush is ahead. In Wisconsin, they used a sample, 38% Republican, 32% Democratic. And sure enough, it looks like Bush is pulling ahead. In Minnesota, they did a sample, 36% GOP, 34% Democrat. And it looks like Bush is ahead by a point or two. What a surprise. This is why, in 2000, the Gallup poll was telling us that George Bush was going to win the popular vote and Al Gore got 500,000 more votes. It's why the Gallup poll is wrong and irrelevant. They are scamming us and lying to us if these statistics are accurate. And perhaps that's strong language, scamming and lying. Let me correct that. Let's just say their information may be less than trustworthy, at least in my humble opinion, if these numbers are accurate. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartman.com, our website. You want to drop into the chat room? Bill in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
You go, Tom. So I saw this movie, Hijacking 9/11.
Yeah, Hijacking Catastrophe. I watched it last night. In fact, we're going to have a couple of the producers on the show today.
Yeah, it was great. I recommend it to everybody. And so they show a map of the proposed oil pipeline in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and surprise, surprise, along the pipeline is where we build our bases.
Yeah, there's two of them exactly alongside it, and one of them nearby.
Yep.
Yeah. So you know what's best about John Kerry?
Well, and also, you know, Hamid Karzai. You know what his job was before he became president of Afghanistan? He worked, he worked for Unocal Oil negotiating a pipeline in Afghanistan.
That's just a coincidence.
Yeah, it is. I know. I understand. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So your question, we got about 10 seconds.
Yeah, so you know what's best about John Kerry?
What's that?
He's not insane.
Yeah, it's the old papoon for president. You know, vote for me. I'm not insane. I agree. Well said, Bill. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Although we do have a guest coming up right after the break. I think you're going to find it fascinating. David J. Morris, who is an embedded journalist with the U.S. Marine Corps, is going to tell us what's really going on in Fallujah and the rest of Iraq. Tom Hartman here with you, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that can be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second-largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the flock, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and they're put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like, a merger of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
are listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The sins of the Father shall be visited upon the Son.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here back with you. Have we lost it? Have we completely lost it? It being Iraq and Afghanistan, the whole thing, the war against terror. David J. Morris, a contributor to Salon Magazine, Salon.com, is also a former Marine officer and the author of Storm on the Horizon. Is that Kafshi, David?
Yes, that's correct.
Kafshi, the battle that changed the course of the Gulf War. He's embedded with the Marines in Fallujah, Iraq in May and June of 2004. David, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. You were over there just after the April assault on Fallujah. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I was there for the month of May and June.
Yeah,
the month.
Tell our listeners what happened.
In the April time frame?
Yeah, yeah. You were there for the kind of, well, at what, okay. The we began with these four contractors getting dragged out of their truck and two of them getting strung up and dragged around and apparently there was a political decision made to respond to that. Is that correct?
That's correct, as I understand it. As my sources indicate, the initiating event, as you mentioned, were the death of the four American contractors in Fallujah, the western edge of town. And the Marines who had been in theater for several months, the inclination at that point, they weren't terribly concerned about what had happened to the contractors, but they had planned some more modest operations to try and capture or selectively target a couple of neighborhoods in town. And for whatever reason, and I'm not sure exactly what happened at the White House, the call came down from Washington to make a strong display to, in fact, punish the residents of Fallujah. And it's interesting to look at the different perception of events. As I have sources that were with several commanding generals, in western Iraq at the time, and when the news reached them about the four contractors being killed, they weren't particularly concerned. They had other preoccupations at the moment. And it was really the concern in Washington that these four contractors' deaths, which some people thought resembled Mogadishu,
mm-hmm.
was going to be a real negative. It was going to have a negative impact on, as far as media coverage. So they felt compelled to. It was really an orientation more on controlling the spin in the United States than actually concern for events on the ground in Iraq.
Yeah, this had nothing to do with what was going to be best for making Iraq more democratic, for winning this, whatever you call this thing, this war, this insurgency, for what's best for the U.S. soldiers, for what's best for the civilians of the country. It was all about George Bush looking like bully boy Mr. Testosterone. You can't push us around, we're going to get you, if I may say so.
Right. I mean, it wasn't, I wouldn't quite put it in those starker terms, but if you look at the nuanced response and kind of the more, surprisingly internationalist and more sensitive approach, surprisingly from the Marines that were on the ground, I went through basic training with the commanding general of the forces out there, and a lot of times the focus is on making relevant military moves in accordance with what the opinions of the locals are on the ground, and this was a case, and it's only becoming clear now that there really was a huge misjudgment from our national leadership in this case, and they really strongly overreacted.
Yeah, we're talking with David J. Morris, Salon contributor, Salon.com. If you have a question or comment, by the way, our number 1-866-889-8894. So here we have the starting point. This incident that got a lot of press because there was a video shot of it. Probably if good, clean video had not appeared, it would have come and gone in one day. But it was there. It was shown on American television. It was shown around the world. It made the Bush administration, in their mind, look weak. They thought that there could be political consequences. And so the word came down to the military, do something about this. Go in, take the city, punish the city. And we did what? We began a punishment of the city.
Exactly. They began planning an offensive operation to go into the town to basically to suppress the entire city because it had, it was perceived that the city of Fallujah was the problem.
Yeah.
It was a very, gross, sort of obtuse approach to it. Corporate punishment. Let's punish the city. Let's go get, let's respond in a really melodramatic fashion.
David Morris, how many people live in Fallujah?
200 to 300,000. I think the population has decreased a little bit since, there's been a lot of combat there. People have gone elsewhere.
Yeah. And so then, okay, the military says, all right, if that's what you want, we'll do it, right? We're going to go in there and they get all set and they're cranking it up and the word goes out, we're going to take Fallujah and they start the attack and we see all this footage of, actually it seems like it was the same loop over and over and over again of these three guys with machine guns, and then what?
Well, the Marines got about halfway into the city. I interviewed Marines from two different battalions that were on the northeast, the southeast and the northwest corners of the city. They began pushing in, and at this point, there was some exceptionally bad coverage, as there will often be when you tell Marines to go take a city, about civilian casualties, and there undoubtedly were civilian casualties. But
they were stacking up bodies of women and children in the soccer field, were they not?
I'm not familiar with that particular footage. As I understand it, as according to what the official Marine story is, that the only civilian casualties were reported by Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect that the Marines had accidentally killed civilians. This is the kind of thing that's going to happen when you send, the military in to go seize a major town.
Yeah.
It remains unclear why the Bush administration didn't foresee this and have some sort of approach to the situation from a media standpoint, because shortly after they send the Marines in, they basically changed their mind. They said, okay, you're attacking the city, we're getting some bad spin now, so let's listen to the locals that are saying that they want a ceasefire.
So the Bush administration flip-flops.
Yes, ironically enough, they flip-flop.
Yeah, and their flip-flop causes essentially the city of Fallujah to become now one of the major strongholds of the opposition, right?
Well, the continuance of this flip-flop, the fact that they allowed the Fallujah Brigade and the locals to essentially run the town, according to every Marine commander in theater, Fallujah is basically a cancer. It's the main enemy sanctuary in western Iraq. There weren't al-Qaeda elements in Iraq prior to the war, but there are all al-Qaeda influenced elements currently operating in Fallujah.
Yeah, and it's not just al-Qaeda here. This is an Associated Press story by Hamza Hawadi. Dateline Fallujah. With U.S. Marines gone and central government authority virtually non-existent, Fallujah resembles an Islamic mini-state. Anyone caught selling alcohol is flogged and paraded in the city. Men are encouraged to wear beards, and barbers are warned against giving Western haircuts. Cleric Abdul Ghatar Al-Alawsi says, after all the blood that was shed and the lives that were lost, we shall only accept God's law in Fallujah. And offering a glimpse of what a future Iraq might look like, he says, we must capitalize on our victory over the Americans and implement Islamic Sharia law. Sunday, for example, scores of mass mujahideen shouting Allah Akbar, or God is great, paraded four men stripped to their underpants atop the back of a pickup truck that drove through the city of Fallujah. Their backs were bleeding from 80 lashes they received as punishment for selling alcohol. I mean, this the coming new Iraq, apparently. And so David J. Morris, you were there. You talked with. What do the Marines think about this? What do the military folks on the ground think about the fact that the White House had essentially hijacked and was trying to micromanage the invasion of one city and said, go in, don't go in, and ended up with this disaster. And to what extent do you think this goes all the way up to George W.?
My sources tell me, and they're very high place, and it's been confirmed by others that it extends all the way to the White House, to the Oval Office. As far as the Marine question, one thing you have to understand as far as Marines go is they're almost religiously apolitical, and they don't really want to put things in Kerry Bush terms, although they will eventually if you get to know them. At the time there was an extreme amount of frustration because Marines are sort of view themselves as simple warriors, almost the samurai kind of ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And if and they want a simple mission, and if you ask them to do a mission or order them, they are happy to do that with enthusiasm. However, they need, you know, you can't contradict yourself 3 weeks later just because the going got tough.
Yeah.
And from their standpoint, they see that as, you know, from their perspective, they're used to decisive action, and they expect clear, emphatic orders from on high. And they didn't get that, and they were very unhappy about it.
Is this symptomatic of something larger? I mean, we saw for months and months and months George Bush saying, everything's fine, we don't want the UN in here, we don't need anybody else, we've got this under control, Paul Bremer's running the country, we're creating a new super conservative economic state that's going to be a model for conservative economics for the world, flat tax of 15%, absolutely open borders, no tariffs whatsoever, no domestic content laws, any transnational corporation can come in and own as much of Iraq as they want and suck 100% of the profits and wealth and resources out of the country, blah, 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 blah. And as it started falling apart, as you know, any rational person could predict outside of the neocon dystopian circles, as it started falling apart, Bush flip-flops and does what John Kerry had been suggesting from the very beginning. You know, let's bring in the United Nations and get them involved in this process. And so the UN comes in and they help put together this thing with Alawi. Was that missed by the military, or was the irony of that something that they noticed as well?
The difference between the ground truth and the rhetoric coming from the White House?
Yeah, and the change in policy, the we don't need no stinking UN to all of a sudden, hey, the UN is going to save this thing.
Well, you know, they're not for the military prides itself on not being politicized.
Yeah.
However, there are, you're beginning to sense, the relationship between the officer of the Office of the Secretary of Defense and Donald Rumsfeld and senior members of the military who have, lifetimes more ground experience, international experience than does Mr. Rumsfeld are beginning to become very frustrated. And the Marines, going all the way back to Vietnam, you see the same trend of very outspoken Marine officers coming back and saying, hey, it's not working. This isn't going to play well, with the troops. We need to rethink what we're doing here. And I think, you won't get that sense talking to a lot of people on the ground because they're trying to, do their daily missions. But
yeah,
there is an intense amount of frustration in the higher levels of the military and the Army and the Marine Corps in particular, whose troops are bleeding and dying, that the mission needs to be clear. We need to refocus on what we're doing and, think a little clearer about what we're attempting to do in Iraq.
Yeah. Now, you, David J. Morris, the author of this article, Turning Point, in Salon.com, are yourself a former Marine officer, right?
Correct.
As a former Marine, and as somebody who was in Iraq for a couple of months, looked at the situation, talked to a lot of military folks, without giving us the official Marine perspective, but your perspective, what do you think is going on? Have we lost this thing? Is it going down the tubes? What direction? What should we be doing? Just broadly, pontificate for a moment for us. Give us that window of insight that seems to be so lacking from the modern media and for those of us who haven't been there.
Well, for me, as a former Marine and then working as a journalist, from the beginning I sensed that the war was a colossal fraud.
Yeah.
So already I thought we started off at in a negative position because it was difficult to, because we were lying to ourselves, it was difficult to clearly articulate what we were attempting to do there.
Okay, by fraud you mean what?
Weapons of mass destruction. I've done some research of my own, talked to people in the Israeli intelligence service, and there was simply no reason to believe Saddam was at best, a regional threat. He never had the means nor the inclination to attack the United States with weapons of mass destruction.
But don't you think that this was? I mean, here's the story that the cons put out. This was actually an intelligence failure. The president actually, in good faith, believed failed intelligence, which said that Saddam was a threat. You think that that's wrong?
The ins and outs of that particular debate, it's difficult to comment upon intelligently because of the life of the debate. However, anyone who was honest with themselves and did any type of independent research you know, as I did and spoke to other individuals that were not politically committed to this cause,
right.
It was very clear that there was never any serious threat from Saddam. There is an inverse relationship between conventional military capability and terrorist capability, i.e., if you have a good army, you don't need to resort to terrorism. Therefore, I mean, Iraq was the least likely state to engage in international terrorism of any Muslim state in the Middle East, and that's a fact.
Because they had an army that Saddam Hussein had good control over.
Right. I mean, use the military to attempt to influence your, you know, to attempt to, you know, inflict your will upon your neighbors. If you have a good military, you don't need to resort to terrorism.
Right.
I mean, the Iranians and the Syrians resorted to international terrorism. And Al-Qaeda, you know, a non-state player, resorted to terrorism because they didn't have a military capability.
Yeah. So we've got about a minute left here, David Morris. Where do we go from here? What should we be doing, the United States?
Well, I think we need to have a real conversation about, you know, what we intend in Iraq. We have a classic guerrilla war that we're facing there. And if we want to win, it's going to take 5 to 10 years to do it. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, how do we want the Middle East to look? What role do we see the United States playing in the international community? You know, we've pretty much alienated most of Western Europe, so it's going to be, you know, us for the short term anyway facing this situation. I think if we really intend to not pull out of there in the next 2 or 3 years, we need to reengage and commit ourselves to the cause.
But every time we kill an insurgent, we're radicalizing another entire family, which might be 20, 30, 40 people in locals. I mean, is this...
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if you're particularly, you know, exceptional...
David, hang on. Let's pick this up on the other side of the break. I got to take a break.
Okay.
This is Veronique Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level, and you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for The Facts on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
Hi. I'm David Orrick. Do you have a dust mask? Well, if you use a bagless vacuum and you're sensitive to dust, a leading consumer magazine products testing magazine warns you should wear a dust mask. But here's a better idea. Try my newest hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL risk-free for 30 days. It uses triple-walled disposable filter bags. Try emptying a bagless vacuum and see what happens. Dust gets all over your hands and face and back into the room and on the kitchen counter. And you get to breathe it in? I believe a vacuum should capture the dust, not your lungs. That's why with my Auric XL, the filter bags are self-sealing. What goes in the bag stays in the bag, even when you empty it. So try my hypoallergenic 8-pound Auric XL free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200. 1-800-989-4200. Then if you still want a bagless vacuum, I'll send you a dust mask to...
This is a Wynn feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. The PBGC was created in 1974 to ensure protected or defined benefit plans, which are a dying breed because workers receive a guaranteed amount of money regardless of their company's investment performance. Most workers are now offered 401k plans, which are not insured and based on the whims of the stock market. Douglas Elliott is president and author of the Coffee Report.
Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation was set up like the FDIC to guarantee bank deposits. The PBGC guarantees that if you are promised a pension, that company goes bankrupt, and there's not enough money in the pension fund, you'll still get the pension.
U.S. Airways announced on Sunday it was returning to bankruptcy for the second time after having already terminated the pilot's pension plan. And now it's revealed intentions to terminate the pensions for all of its other labor union employees.
There's a limit on how much is guaranteed. One of the limitations is that no more than, I think, $44,000 a year of pension will be guaranteed. And there are people in these unions that will earn pensions greater than that. The amount in excess of that limit, they will not receive.
In principle, corporations are required to contribute enough money to the PBGC to cover all future pension payments. But employers are getting around their obligations by abusing flexibility on the timing of their contributions.
There needs to be a different balance, either less risk being taken on or more premiums to offset that risk. And it was kind of masked in the 90s when everybody was seeming to do much better than they really were. And stock prices were high, which helped pension funds that invested in stocks. And it also made it less likely that companies would go bankrupt.
Elliott says that to date, American corporations have promised their employees more than $1.5 trillion worth of pension payments. And if they can't pay out, the burden falls on the PBGC and ultimately the U.S. taxpayer. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't stand by while democracy dies. Don't stand by. Don't swallow their lies.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Broadcasting live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite, and beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. We're talking with David Morris, a Salon contributor, former Marine officer and author, who is embedded with the Marines. David, you were just getting into the answer to the question that I had, which basically was rooted in the notion that, from Algeria to Vietnam, I don't know of any time that a nation has tried to play empire, reach out and take on a popular insurgency in another nation and over the long run has succeeded. And I'm just skeptical about our ability to do that. Before you answer that, though, let's take a quick call from Alice in Old Joe, Arkansas. Maybe you can give us a twofer and answer both questions. Is that okay with you?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Alice, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. How are you today?
Great. What's up?
I was just listening to him, and I had just finished reading an article by John Pilger from the New Statesman called John Pilger Hears Blair Echo Mussolini.
Yeah.
And in the article, he mentions Fallujah and the killing of the 600 people after the attack on the, he refers to them as mercenaries. And makes this statement, 60 years earlier, the SS Das Reich division killed 600 French civilians at Oradour sur Glane as revenge for the kidnapping of a German officer by the resistance. Is there a difference?
Yeah. Well, excellent question. David, your thoughts on Alice's comment and also, essentially my question. Is this thing winnable or are we, this is essentially the question Don Rumsfeld was asking himself in the memo that I don't think he intended ever to make public. For everyone we kill, are we creating 10?
Well, I would strongly resist the characterization of, Marines as being equivalent to the Nazi SS. I had several friends and journalist colleagues that were there for the assault on Fallujah, and they speak speak at great length at the selective intentions of the Marines to not engage or kill civilians, and the Nazi SS clearly was more systematic in its genocidal activity and much more disrespectful of human rights than I think the Marine Corps is. Speaking from
Agreed.
Personal and journalistic experience,
yeah.
As far as talking about larger guerrilla war questions. There are a few selected cases in history, in 20th century history, of an imperial type power actually winning a nationalist insurgency type
situation. For
example, in both Malaya and Greece, the British both prevailed.
Yeah, but they're not still controlling them. I mean, they didn't. Ultimately, the countries became independent nations.
Correct. That's
and Greece still has.
In the long term, you have to ask yourself: Is an imperial type situation something that the United States is willing to commit itself to?
Yeah. Well,
and I don't think there's really recognition that this is a full blown guerrilla war in Iraq.
And we have to deal with it. David, thank you very much for being with us. David J. Morris, Salon contributor. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information. Available in...
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the FLOC, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like: a merger of some of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
13 million. Who will give me 14? I have 14 million. Do I hear 15? 15, 16. There to you, sir.
Political power doesn't come cheap in America.
Sold for $22 million of other rollback in air quality regulations.
George Bush understands that money equals power. His campaign spent nearly $50 million this March alone. That's a record.
Next on the block, the First Amendment. Who will give me 1 million?
Just because it's a democracy doesn't mean it's free. How much is your vote worth?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Poor Richard. Richard Perle is a right-wing neocon theorist who wants to be taken seriously as both a governmental and corporate insider. But he keeps taking highly public pratfalls that would be absolutely comical if they weren't so ugly. Perle, who's tight with Dick Cheney and Donnie Rumsfeld, was one of the main architects of George W.'s disastrous policies in Iraq. He was the chief proponent of the fanciful notion that our invading troops would be greeted by grateful people tossing rose petals at them. Instead, angry Iraqis are tossing bombs, and more than 1,000 of our troops are dead. Richard is not doing any better in the corporate world. His latest pratfall is as a board member of Hollinger International, a media conglomerate that owns such papers as the Chicago Sun-Times and Jerusalem Post. The head honcho of Hollinger, Lord Conrad Black, now stands accused of having looted some $400 million from the corporation. Perle was not merely on the board, but on the executive committee, with a direct fiduciary responsibility to protect the interests of the shareholders. But this supposed watchdog was Lord Black's lapdog. Perle admits that he personally rubber-stamped stacks of financial documents involving Black's looting, signing the papers without even reading them. One reason that Perle was so head-in-the-sand irresponsible is that he was enjoying the corporate gravy, too. In a sweetheart deal, he directed a Hollinger division that let him pocket $3 million, even though this division lost $49 million on Perle's watch. But Richard now claims that he's a victim. After Lord Black's corporate kleptocracy was exposed, and after an internal report nailed Perle for his flagrant abdication of duty, Richard loudly proclaimed to the media that he had been duped by his former friend and benefactor. This is Jim Hightower saying, poor Richard. I guess he was duped into putting those millions into his own pockets, too.
The following is brought to you by Pfizer and Viagra Sildenafil Citrate.
So this morning, I'm looking into my shaving mirror. My wife's still in bed. And this guy is staring back at me with a mischievous glint in his eye. He looks familiar. So I say, Wild Thing? Is that you? You're back.
Not all medications are for everyone, so consult with your doctor first. Then ask if Viagra is right for you. To learn more, visit Viagra.com.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour, moving right along. Les Chorba, author of the new book, Trust, the One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader, writes, Dan Rather's unwillingness and lack of courage to seriously re-examine his sources and the truth of his story on the President's National Guard service until mounting pressure forced him to provides further evidence why journalists are one of the least trusted professions in America. Les, are you not a journalist?
I'm not. I'm an executive search consultant. I have written a few columns now and then, but
so we shouldn't trust.
I don't pretend to be a member of the profession.
So we shouldn't trust you when you write.
Well, I hope that the material that I put out there is vetted and accurate. But I think certainly Dan Rather, who is one of the major icons in major media, should be expected to be trusted and vet his sources a little more carefully.
Yeah, and he certainly has for 30 years, and he really blew it with this one. And he has now come out and said that he's sorry, he was wrong.
Right.
They're still looking into this. Why hasn't at the same time George W. Bush come out and said that he lied to us, just, you know, completely right up front lied to us when he said that his father being a congressman had nothing to do with his getting into the Air National Guard and leaping ahead over 250 people on the waiting list?
Well, let me first address the issue of whether Dan Rather has really apologized. I mean, he said he was sorry, but for what? That he was misled by a source, or that he misled the American public and his viewers? He needs to be clear on that. If he wants to restore and rebuild his trust, which I believe he's capable of doing, because as you correctly point out, he has a track record of trustworthiness. But we need to understand what he's apologizing for. He's not been clear on it, and he's not showing genuine humility.
Yeah, Les, I'm a little more interested in the guy who's running for president of the United States.
Right.
You know, now he's been caught in at least one
lie
here.
Your point is what?
He's been caught in a whole bunch of lies. Why should we continue to trust him? For example, why, if Dan Rather has come out and said, well, even forget about Dan Rather, why hasn't George Bush responded to the allegation of Ben Barnes and others that he was leaped ahead of a whole bunch of other people on the waiting list for the Texas Air National Guard because his draft number was up so he wouldn't have to go off and serve in Vietnam?
Well, he has responded to this story, as you know, very well, time and time again. When he ran for governor here in Texas, this whole thing was brought up. It was brought up again in 2000.
Right, and his response every time was a lie.
It was brought up by John Kerry this spring when he personally challenged the president's credibility. By the way, the president has never publicly challenged John Kerry's record in Vietnam. In fact, he said that he served more honorably than he has.
I am speaking of George Bush's lies here. We're talking about leadership and lying. I mean, your book, Trust, the One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader. Here we got a guy who is the leader of the free world. And he has come out, and as you correctly say, on a number of occasions, he has been challenged on, how did you get into that National Guard thing?
Mm-hmm.
And every time he has said in public to reporters, oh, it was just a coincidence, or my family had nothing to do with it. Yet he told his professor at Harvard that his daddy pulled strings for him, and now the guy who pulled the strings has come forward and on national television signed a sworn affidavit and has at least a couple of witnesses to back it up, plus these phony documents, which the whole focus now has been shifted to the phony documents. But see, we can completely set that aside. There's still this guy saying George Bush lied, and Bush is refusing to respond to this. He's been caught in a lie, hasn't he?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't there 30 years ago, and I don't think most Americans are really looking back at 30 years and whether or not the president's father was able to help him get into the National Guard. I mean, that you really think that's the critical issue in this campaign?
Well, how about his lies on Iraq?
Well, let me see. You think that the president of the United States and Colin Powell, when the rest of the world community, including John Kerry and Ted Kennedy and Bill Clinton and all the Democrats, said publicly that Saddam Hussein not only used weapons of mass destruction, we know that for a fact, but also possessed them, that they deliberately would go to the UN and the world community and mislead?
Well, it sure looks that way.
Is that plausible?
Yeah, absolutely. You had Doug Feist setting up the Office of Special Plans inside the Pentagon, cherry picking intelligence to hand off to Bush and to all these other all these folks were relying on information from the administration. The administration's information was wrong. The question becomes: Did the intelligence community lie to or let down or screw up with regard to George Bush? So George Bush was, when he told the world a lie, it really wasn't a lie. It was just misinformation, and he was misinformed.
Or did he intelligently lie? There's a difference between willful and conscious deception.
That's the point I just made.
And a major intelligence blunder. Clearly, this was an intelligence blunder, and it has not helped the president's credibility. I will grant you that. But it was the president, according to Bob Woodward's book, who challenged his CIA director Tenet and said, "Are you absolutely certain and Tenet said it was a slam dunk.
Let me ask you a question. Right. Let me ask you a question. Just, you know, let's just be real here.
Sure.
You run a business. You run an executive search firm. I come to you and I say, that's an imperfect. Let's say you're president of the United States. And I come to you and I say, I've got some information that on the basis of which I'm going to encourage you to start a war with another country. Tens of thousands of people are going to die. It's going to cost not just millions, not just hundreds of millions, but hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right.
It's going to make or break the reputation of the United States. It's going to have significant political consequences. I lay out the information for you, and you say to me, come on, this isn't enough for me. And I say, oh, don't worry, it's a slam dunk. Don't you think if you had any intelligence at all, you'd say, well, then prove it to me?
Well, let's see. The proof was out there. We saw it in the reports. We not only saw it in intelligence, but the UN and in France and Germany. Everybody recognized universally that Saddam Hussein used weapons of mass destruction. They were not in compliance with the UN. Moreover, we have now learned that you got to put all of this into context. And I know you're fair, but you got to look at all the material that the president had in front of him. He had a Russian intelligence report by Vladimir Putin saying that Saddam Hussein, after 9/11, wanted to hit us. So we knew that for sure. He also was operating in a post 9/11 world where we have enemies who want to attack us. We also were engaged in a war with Iraq. Remember, our planes, our fighter pilots, were being shot at every single day when we were trying to enforce the no-fly zone
by a country that no longer had an air force. Come on, Les. 15 of the hijackers were.
That's right,
were
but
were Saudi.
They were shooting at our pilots. So we have a responsibility to enforce those resolutions.
And we were shooting back. We were bombing them. We bombed them 231 times in the first 6 months of that year.
Right. Right. But I think that the president decided and made a decision, a policy decision, that we weren't going to go out there and swat flies anymore, that in a post 9/11 world, we wanted to take this mass murderer, this enemy of freedom, this individual, Saddam Hussein, who was proposing instability in the region, who, by the way, was supporting terrorists in Hamas by $25,000 to the families of those that...
Kim, and how many other countries? Bombers. How many other countries were supporting Hamas?
Well, lots of others, but Saddam Hussein was our sworn enemy, and we were at war with him.
Yeah, right.
And he's killed 10% of his own people. So we had a responsibility to the Iraqi people.
Robert Mugabe has killed 2 million people in the last 5 years. Where is our indignation about Mugabe?
Well, we weren't in a state of war with him. Okay, we were in a state of war with Saddam Hussein. He was threatening our allies in the region, one of which is Israel.
We had won that war in 1991. We pushed him back into his box. We were not in a state of war with Saddam Hussein.
But we were still in a state of war.
No, we were not.
And by the way, you know, everybody says there's no, you know, a lot of people like to dismiss the notion that Al-Qaeda is not involved in Iraq. We now know that Al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian terrorist who has set up shop in Iraq, was there long before the Iraq war. We now know that. So there is a connection between Al-Qaeda. And so it was important for the president in a post 9/11 world to show leadership.
You think Iraq was the only country that Al-Zarqawi ever visited before 9/11?
No, but I think that he certainly...
Les,
understood.
Why do you think it is that the majority, that 30% of Americans and 70% of Fox News watchers think that there were Iraqis on those planes that hit the towers?
I don't know. That's obviously wrong information because we know most of them were Saudis.
Yeah. Do you think it could have something to do with lies coming out of the Bush administration?
I don't think I would challenge you to go back and check the record. I don't think this president and this administration ever once said that Iraqis had anything to do with 9/11. That's just false. I would challenge you on that. There's no such record.
All right.
We said all along there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, but he did harbor terrorists, not only Al-Qaeda terrorists, but also Hamas and other organizations.
Yeah, I'm looking for the clip here. I actually have the clips of George Bush saying that, and Trust
well,
me.
That would be news to me. And,
yeah,
the
way he did it is, you know, there's this slick little psychological trick of saying, you know, 9-11, Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein. And so you get a situation where yesterday Donald Rumsfeld is mixing up Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. He's going, I don't know where Saddam Hussein is. He's hiding somewhere. Right. This is psychological warfare on the American people, Les, isn't it?
Yeah, let me say, you know, to you and to your listeners. I mean, I have been obviously I worked for the president's father and I support the president, but I have been.
But the president's father didn't support this war.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, certainly all the people he surrounded himself. Brent Scowcroft was outspoken.
Well, Brent Scowcroft was an outspoken critic, but Brent Scowcroft didn't operate in a post 9/11 world. They don't know what they're talking about. They know what they were talking pre 9/11, but everything's changed.
So after 9/11, Brent Scowcroft became stupid.
No, he doesn't understand because he's not there every day reading the intelligence reports. He doesn't understand what it's like to be president and national security advisor in a time of war that we're facing now. It's totally changed.
Okay.
And so we need a new policy, and the policy is preemption, which, by the way, the American people seem to be supporting overwhelmingly, because on the issue of terror and on the issue of Iraq, the president leads anywhere from 10 to 30 points.
Yeah, and a whole lot of Germans supported Hitler when he said, we've got to get Poland before they get us.
Well, there you go.
Equating
the president with Adolf Hitler, that's brilliant.
I'm perfectly willing to equate the policy of preemption, which has only been used in the last century by one other government, that being of Adolf Hitler's, with this, yeah, absolutely. 1-866-889-8894 telephone. Now, let's take a quick call, Les. We've got about a minute and a half before we've got to take a break. Here's Scott in Santa Fe on the line with us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? I wanted to actually go back to, I know you guys, everybody's supposed to get over it, but I want to go back to the issue of Bush's military service record. I want to talk about two other appraisals of his service record, because I do think that this points to a basic issue of character.
Okay, Scott, I'm going to have to ask you to hold on to that thought, and we'll pick it up on the other side of the break.
Okay.
We're talking with Les Czorba, C-S-O-R-B-A, author of the new book, Trust, The One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader. It's a Tom Hartman radio program. Stick around. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. In vacuums, bagless is a dirty word. A leading consumer testing magazine warns, if you're sensitive to dust, avoid bagless vacuums. And if you own one, they advise you to wear a dust mask. I would never put the Orrick name on a bagless vacuum. They're filthy. My hypoallergenic Orrick XL uses triple-walled, disposable filter bags. They hold four times more than the leading brand of bagless vacuums. What goes in the Orrick bag stays in the bag, including bacteria and viruses. Empty a bagless vacuum, and the dust goes right back into the room you've just cleaned. Is this sanitary? Orrick cleans the air as it vacuums the floor. Try my 8-pound Orrick XL risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. It's the clean alternative to bagless vacuums.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research.
That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA.
You must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th.
And welcome back.
2001. America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
This in the context of a speech about Saddam.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Les Chorba, the author of Trust, the One Thing That Makes or Breaks a Leader. And Les, we got the phone lines are lit up here. Let's finish up with Scott. Scott, if you can make it quick, because we've got a bunch of calls and we've only got about 5 minutes in this segment.
Okay, well, just very quickly, the Boston Globe the day before the CBS 60 Minutes report poured back over the records that the Bush administration itself had released. And, concluded that he had not fulfilled his service to the Guard. You can also look at the assessment of Reagan's own, I don't remember exactly who it was, Deputy Defense Secretary, who basically called him AWOL, if not deserter, based on the documents that had been released. That's a Republican right there. And I think that for the neocons who are behind him, whom he doesn't seem to be able to say no to, I don't think that's leadership. I think that represents a very specific moral cowardice when you're not making decisions for yourself. That basically that what everybody
well, that's a guess on your part.
Chicken hawk behind him.
Let me respond to this. First of all, the records show that were released by the White House and the Pentagon that the president earned more than enough points to be honorably discharged. If you look specifically each year. The 6 years that he served, just under 6 years, he needed 50 points each year to qualify.
Les, respectfully,
far more than enough.
Respectfully,
points.
That specifically is the point that the Boston Globe refuted last week.
Let me finish. Secondly, he flew one of the most dangerous interceptor jets that were around, the F-102,
and
which, by the way, was decommissioned.
Drug test, and then he decided that
so you're talking about Chicken Hawk and Carrot. You're talking about Chicken Hawk and Carrot.
So he didn't have to fly
he
anymore.
He flew an airplane that was considered to be the most dangerous. In fact, they decommissioned it because it was unsafe. So I think that takes some courage.
2 years after he decided not to fly. And he decided on his own not to fly. He decided on his own not to show up for physical. And he decided that he had a special relationship with the military to head over to Harvard Business School. He's admitted that himself. And for those other guardsmen who couldn't come up with that special relationship with the military to go to Harvard Business School, I think he owes an apology, frankly.
I think you would be correct if he didn't earn the points. However, he earned the points, and so he was granted an honorable discharge and was allowed to go to Harvard Business School.
Yeah.
But most importantly, here's the issue. The American people have seen his qualifications as Commander-in-Chief, almost 4 years of steady principal leadership. And on the question of Commander-in-Chief, who do you trust, he leads by 20 to 30 points in all major national polls.
Steady principal leader. He opposed the Homeland Security Department, then he embraced it. He opposed creation of the 9/11 Commission, then he supported it. He first refused to speak to its members,
then he agreed only if Dick Cheney could come with him. Right now, Tom, both those points are not true.
He argued for free trade, then he puts on a three-year tariff on steel, then he withdraws it after 21 months.
Yeah.
He says the war on terror can be won, then he reversed himself the next day and said it couldn't, then he reversed himself the next day and said it could. A week after 9/11, he says, Osama bin Laden wanted dead or alive. 6 months later, he says, and I quote, I truly am not that concerned about him, end quote. He says in July 20th, he says to Tim Russert, he says, I'm a war president. 3 days later, he says, nobody wants to be a war president. I want to be a peace president. This is steady leadership?
Yeah, very steady, very principled. That's what Rudy Giuliani and John McCain, highly trusted and respected men.
Rudy Giuliani, the guy who announced to his wife that he was getting a divorce on TV.
Yeah, well... I think that the polls show that the president is now leading on the question of trustworthiness and honesty. And by the way, he leads overall.
Hey, Les, we got to take a break. Do you want to stick around and talk about this some more?
I'd love to. I've got another show right at 1:30 Eastern. So I'd love to come back.
Okay, we'll bring it back another time then.
I'd love to come back.
Okay, thanks a lot.
A lot of fun. Thanks.
Good talking to you, Les. Bye now.
Thank you.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second-largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the flock, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and they put in the government computer so that worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Monalov agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like, a merger of some of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. It's the bottom of the second hour of our program, and Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service traditionally, or Victoria Jones, calls in and gives us an update, and Ellen is there with us on the line. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so
much. Hey, Ellen, before you get...
There's a ton going on today.
Yeah, I know.
I first have to just tell you I was so excited this morning to attend the opening, or the at least the parade. I didn't go to the full opening ceremonies of the National Museum of the American Indian. Tom, I talked to people from all over the country and from Canada. I talked to one amazing guy from Louisiana. His tribe is not considered federally identified tribe. But he, because they don't have enough numbers, but essentially there's only two people, including he's one of them, that speaks the language of his tribe in the whole world.
Wow. Yeah, it's a similar situation here in Vermont with the Abenaki. They're trying to get federal recognition, and the court, actually, there was a forced sterilization program in the 1920s where they sterilized all the Abenaki women, and a bunch of them went into hiding to avoid being sterilized, and the court claimed... The Supreme Court passed down this ruling. It's about 6 years ago. As 100 Abenaki are standing there, said the Abenaki official do not exist because they were all sterilized, you know, because there was no record of anybody other than being sterilized. Ellen, we just had a rip-roaring debate here in the last half hour with a right-winger, and I got a couple of callers who want to just finish this stuff off.
Go, and I'm curious to see what they say.
Okay.
I'm in no hurry.
Okay, cool. If you can hang out. In fact, you can pitch in here. Let's take a couple of these calls. Brian in Santa Fe, New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a wrong button. Now, that should be Brian in Santa Fe. Hey, Brian.
Am I there? Hello?
Yeah, Brian, you're live.
Yeah, okay. Hey, yeah, I'm sorry I missed last. It really makes my blood boil when these guys get their facts so wrong just for their own purposes.
He was really good with his talking points, wasn't he?
A steady, principled leadership.
Oh, and I'm glad you tore him apart. Of course, he's not going to listen to that, but you were right. I wanted to bring up three things that I would have mentioned to him. One is Dennis Kucinich was here just before we invaded Iraq, and he was campaigning against it. And one of the he's on the House Intelligence Committee or subcommittee, and he specifically stated that committee had absolutely no proof of any kind, any way, shape, or form, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And he said, we have the technology to tell. We can do it with satellites if we want
to.
That was the one point. The other point was that these people conveniently forget Hans Blix's findings.
Yeah.
Before the invasion.
Oh, I know. I was
like, it never happened.
I know. We were just kind of skipping all over, and we were really short on time. I mean, as you know, that's usually what I beat these guys up with. They go, everybody in the world thought there were weapons of mass destruction. I'm sorry. The whole world didn't think there were weapons of mass destruction. The whole world was very skeptical, which is why the whole world didn't go with us.
That's right. Anyway. And the third point is that not only did Kofi Annan think this, decide this was an illegal invasion, we as signatories to the UN treaty and charter incorporate that treaty into our body of law as per our constitution.
Right, which is why exactly, and it's why Kofi Annan basically day before yesterday said George Bush is a war criminal. This war was illegal. Brian, thanks for the call.
It's interesting. There are some news sources now that saying that people at the United Nations, some of the officials are sort of trying to go into some control mode over his remarks, mm-hmm. And trying to say, well, he didn't say anything really different than what he had said in May, and that apparently, also spoke with Colin Powell and John Danforth and Foreign Secretary Strzok to basically smooth over the flap, and he said there has been no change in his position on Iraq.
Very, very interesting. Sanitizing this thing as fast as they can. Well, you know, it's the United States is one of the major contributors to the UN. It's there in New York, and they got to deal with George Bush whether they like it or not. Here's Billy in Santa Fe. Hey, Billy, what'd you think about this?
Oh, this guy was hilarious. He's a classic Heritage Foundation graduate, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, he worked for Bush Sr., so he's been
around for a while. Right, but yeah, the way he reeled through those talking points. But, I mean, guys like that, do they really think that people are... that everybody out here is that stupid? I mean...
Well, they're used to going on Fox News, where I think... actually, maybe everybody is that stupid, and not by birth, but by being dumbed down by you know, being assaulted by that media.
Well, I mean, Hussein was he was a CIA creation, you know, a la Manuel Noriega, and when he outlived his usefulness, they just used him and threw him away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point. Thanks a lot, Brian, or Billy, rather. We got another Billy. One last call here, Ellen, and we'll get back to the New York, to the report from Washington D.C. Billy in Santa Cruz, California, on the line. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So
it was a wild
here's
one.
Just a couple of takes from this whole thing. And first of all, I was just talking with my wife about how much fun it would be to talk about to sprinkle into this discussion what we all did to get out of that war.
Sure.
My story is a good one. At some point, I need to tell it on your air. It's very funny.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is that, you know, and my wife would say, well, you know, you shouldn't admit that none of us wanted to go to that war because then it makes Bush not look as bad as he is. I said, honey, the rest of us aren't sending kids to die.
Well, beyond that, Bush was out speaking in favor of the war.
Exactly. Well, that's it. So we don't have to pretend that we were all for the war. It's the total behavior around the war and that whole chicken hawk thing.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. By the way, I figured out what the October surprise is.
What's it going to be?
Bush is actually going to enlist in the army and go fight in Iraq like a human being, like a man.
Yeah, well, maybe his daughters, right?
Oh, yeah, right. He's not really a man.
They're of the age.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing?
Yes, sir.
So at the center of this whole thing is a woman named Mary Mapes. She is the producer for Dan Rather.
Right.
Responsible for all this mess.
Right.
You know what? She's a really great gal. She's really sweet. I met her about 10, 15 years ago in Mexico, and when she was staying in a room next to mine when I was studying hypnotherapy in Mexico, of all things.
Huh.
And let me tell you something. She was really nice to me. I wasn't there with my wife, and she and her boyfriend took me under their wing. She's a great gal, and I don't care about this crap.
Yeah, okay. Well said, Billy. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from you. 20 minutes before the hour. Chuck and Los Alamos, hang on. Well, let's get back to Ellen here, because Ellen, I value your time, and we've only got 10 minutes left in this segment, and I want to hear what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Okay, well, just to follow up on what your caller said in terms of what's happening with Memogate, as it's now being called in Washington, people have been talking about Joe Lockhart having a few-minute conversation with the guy, Bill Burkett.
Yeah.
And the administration, particularly the president's reelect committee, went all nuts about this. A friend of mine who's actually at the reelect committee, she's their communications director, Nicole Devenish, she said that if Dan Bartlett, who's White House communications director, or she, had done exactly what Lockhart did, then it would be plastered all over the front page above the fold of the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera. I don't actually agree with that.
I doubt
but
it.
That's the word from the officials. Meanwhile, of course, in addition to opening the museum today, the president made a he didn't open the museum, but there was an opening of the museum today. There was an address to the United Nations.
Well, Ellen, before you move along to that, let me just ask you a question here about this Memogate thing. I don't know if you caught the article I wrote on Common Dreams yesterday, but
I did.
Okay, I think there's a really legitimate question. Is it possible that the way that Bill Burka got this document was by it coming out of Karl Rove's office?
I have said that from the get-go.
How come nobody's talking about this?
I think Rove is behind this, but, you know, I'm a member of the Black Helicopter crowd.
But see, don't you find it interesting that none of these guys on the right are asking where did this memo come from? They all want to point fingers and yell and jump up and down,
well,
and who talked to
who? Well, I think Bill Burkett was the one who made the memo.
You really think so? I mean, I've not heard anybody allege that.
That is, on right-wing talk radio, that is what I'm hearing.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so Bill Burkett has become a document expert, an expert forger.
He's the one, apparently, that they believe did this, yes.
Yeah, except
I don't believe it, but that's what they believe.
Yeah, but with Dan Rather, Bill Burkett says that he's still trying to protect his source. He's still refusing to say where he got it from.
This is going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Apparently CBS has assigned like 12 reporters to try and find out where it came from.
Yeah. Because in my opinion, that's the real story. Where did this thing come from? And how did a right-wing lawyer who was associated with Ken Starr and who wrote the legal brief to cause Bill Clinton to lose his law license 3 hours after the TV program aired know enough about the typographic nuance of those memos to post it on a website owned by the guy who is the co-author of the Swift Boat book?
I mean, this is definitely spy versus spy.
Oh, it stinks. It absolutely stinks. Okay, you wanted to move along to the UN. Well, I heard the speech.
Okay.
I thought
the president was at the UN today, and he talked about fighting terrorism. He talked about protecting human dignity, referred to the United States as my country a couple of times in the speech. He talked about ethnic cleansing, genocide, etc. But I think he said that he then talks about the main terrorist goal is to undermine, disrupt, influence elections. I mean, standard Bush stuff. He did. First of all, I have to say two things about the speech. One, it was extremely well written and well crafted.
Yes, it was.
Beautifully done, honestly. I mean, I don't agree with him, but it was beautiful. Secondly, he called on the Arab countries to end incitement in their own media, cut off public and private funding for terrorism, and establish normal relations with Israel. He also went on to Israel, and he said they should impose a settlement freeze, dismantle unauthorized outposts, and end the daily humiliation of the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a positive step.
Yeah, it's a beginning.
It is a beginning. Now, then the Kerry campaign came right back after this and said that his UN speech was wrong choices that have weakened the U.S. national security, and said that he misled the people. I mean, that's what they're saying. And they said it's not, the Kerry campaign said it was not a choice between dictatorship and democracy in Iraq. It was between fighting and winning a war against al-Qaeda, and that we were taking U.S. resources and attention to Iraq when it should be in other places. So that's kind of interesting on that front.
Yeah, yeah. And true, I think.
and very true.
What a surprise.
Yes.
Yeah. So carry on.
Oh, carry on. Okay. Also, rumor has it that some of the Bush people are pretty happy with Kerry's attack on Iraq. They said that they believe that he has moved to a position of prematurely withdrawing troops and ending the war in Iraq. And they feel like that's something they can fight against. This morning, The Senate Intelligence Committee voted 12-4, one abstention, and I'm not sure who was the abstaining person, to approve the nomination of Porter Goss. And so it looks like that is going to go before the full Senate, and of course it will pass.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you heard about this little item, but Haaretz this morning, that is the Israeli newspaper, says that Israel is going to buy $319 million worth of bombs, including bunker busters, which they know that they will not use against the Palestinians.
And do you know where that $390 million, which is going to U.S. corporations, is coming from?
$319.
You know where that's coming from? It's coming directly out of U.S. military aid to Israel. In other words, our tax dollars are being given to Israel as military aid.
So that they can buy it.
So
but you know something? I used to do the radio program for the Agency for International Development and under the Clinton administration. 70% of all U.S. aid comes back to the United States.
Sure. Well, we're no dummies.
Right.
We're no dummies.
It's just corporate welfare for the farmers and the this and the that.
And the bomb makers, in this case. And the bomb makers.
Yeah. And you know, I'll never forget the night before Clinton's inauguration. There was a party being given by Susan Thomas, and I was at the party with my brother, and I said, who is that person he was talking to? And he says, oh, they're arms dealers.
Yeah.
I thought, we're electing this guy, and nothing's changed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's remarkable. Okay, Ellen, thank you. Anything
I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, great. Have a great afternoon. Thanks. I appreciate the report. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Let's pick up some of these calls here. Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Hey, Chuck.
Hey, Tom. You know, I've been doing some research on discharges from
yes.
the military during the Vietnam era.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things is that if you get even an undesirable discharge.
You can automatically get it upgraded to a general.
You absolutely can. And
yeah.
I mean, I know guys that went AWOL that did a lot of things, and they got all the way upgraded. Sometimes it helps if you hire a lawyer.
Right.
And it certainly wouldn't hurt if your father was who your father was.
Right.
And,
my guess is Bush got a general discharge and it got upgraded. But, in all the documents, now I'm not an expert on this stuff and I haven't poured over every single document, but I would think that if he had been honorably discharged, that a copy of his honorable discharge papers would be plastered in every story, and I've never seen that. Have you?
Well, exactly, and here's what's really interesting. It's kind of like if you commit a, not a real bad indiscretion, but a problem when you're a minor. They destroy all your records
right.
when you hit a certain point. Once you get upgraded, they actually pull all the information that showed that you were upgraded.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've done a lot of looking at this in the last couple of days because this really bugs me. And the whole thing about the number of points that your previous talker talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. They say he got 50 points, 50 points, blah, blah, blah. But the 50 points could be added to after the fact.
Yeah, it could be wrong. Okay, Chuck, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Florence in Grand Rapids. Florence, we're almost out of time here. If it's quick, if it's not, I can hold you over the break. What's up?
I'm calling because I wanted to say I was pleased to meet you in Grand Rapids Plus.
Oh, well, thank you.
I want to know when this president goes to the United Nations. Nobody questions him about the tortures in Abu Ghraib and Mosul now that are coming out, or about what's his name's book. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And why aren't you people talking about it?
Well, I have been, and it's becoming increasingly, I think, self-evident. Florence, we got to move along. Thanks for raising the point, though, and we'll get more back to it.
Do you want to find out what the invasion of Iraq was really about? Read the new illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Once you've read We the People, you'll understand why conservatives are trying to bankrupt government and how perpetual war is used as a political strategy in the United States. You'll learn how our votes are in danger and what we must do about it. You'll discover why the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 matter today. Populist watchdog and national radio commentator Jim Hightower had this to say about We the People.
Not only does this book tell you what's really going on, but it even draws you a picture of it. Read, learn, and act.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. A compelling story of how a government by and for the people has been replaced by corporate domination. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People issues a call to action in a most entertaining way. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for the facts on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
A long-term study of Yellowstone National Park shows that wildfires are good for fish and other aquatic life. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. One of the arguments against letting wildfires burn is that they destroy forested slopes and leave the land open to erosion. But a new book about the 1988 fires in Yellowstone National Park shows that even erosion sometimes has its place in nature. Linda Wallace is a wildfire expert at the University of Oklahoma and the editor of After the Fires, a collection of reports on Yellowstone's recovery from the 1988 event. She says she was surprised by one study's finding that erosion is vital to aquatic life in the park's rivers and streams.
The erosion processes in Yellowstone are very, very important. And one of the things that the geological history has shown us is that we have these massive amounts of erosion occurring off and on. It turns out that even for the aquatic systems, that these erosion processes are very, very critical because they set up new spawning beds in streams and creeks, and that actually helps fish populations in the years following a fire.
Wallace says the influx of soil and ash is initially tough on fish, killing many of them.
During an erosion event, the creeks and streams, of course, get extremely muddy and fishing is impossible. Fish will die with their gills clogged. Those fish that manage to survive, though, will find the next year wonderful spawning area, and then their populations will actually respond positively.
These periodic erosion events also deliver minerals and other vital nutrients into the streams, an essential process in a nutrient-poor landscape. Wallace says these findings add support for the view that wildfires are an important part of many ecosystems, even some that are underwater. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds?
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And welcome back.
Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation.
4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's see here, it's Brian in Grand Rapids is on the phone. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you, brother?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Brian?
Well, I was watching GW again on TV, and he's been having all kinds of trouble lately with everybody saying how bad Iraq is. Well, all of a sudden, they get the Iraqi interim prime minister, Mr. Alawi, all up and down New York, parading him around, saying how rosy and how great everything is over in Iraq. That it's not really a problem. Everything's just fine. A couple of little skirmishes here and there. Are these people, do you think we're blind or stupid?
Well, I remember a series of presidents of South Vietnam. It's, I mean, this is like flashback all over again. You know, it's who. Everything's fine. I'm drawing a blank on the various names now. But if you're old enough, you remember we had the same thing. We had, you know, there was a series of basically puppet presidencies of South Vietnam, and one would get knocked off or whatever, and we'd get another one in there. And it was always, yeah, everything's fine. It's just around the corner. Victory's just, we just need to kill a few more people. And what they didn't get is that when you are not of that nation, I mean, popular uprisings, domestic popular uprisings, even terrorist uprisings within a country very often actually work. But when from outside of a country, when somebody from outside a country comes in and says, okay, we are going to impose a form of government on you, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. And you kill one soldier, one nasty guy, and that nasty guy has a family, and that family lives in that country. And so, I mean, you know, they kill an American soldier, and it might really upset, it might destroy the lives of 20, 30 people here in the United States who are related to that soldier, but they're in the United States. They're not going to be putting Claymore mines under cars and trucks in the United States. I mean, you know, but over in Iraq, you kill a local Iraqi, and you say, oh, well, we killed a terrorist. Well, that guy's got a family. And you're radicalizing the populace by engaging in this kind of warfare. And it doesn't work. It will not work. We need to back out of there as quickly as we can, assuming that we have some sort of a political solution. Brian, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. You know, we can do better than this, my friends. We can do so much better than this. Check out johncarey.com. And I say this, I am not a Democrat, and I say this. We can do better.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
A criminal investigation is underway over Halliburton's $180 million payment to Nigerian officials for a natural gas project back when Dick Cheney was the CEO. Critics call this bribery, but in many countries, bribes are just part of the political culture. Why should Dick's company be punished for being sensitive to local customs? You give money to politicians and they give favors to you. We do it all the time here in the U.S., only we call it a campaign contribution, and no one seems to object. South of the border, it's la mordita, the little bite, and in the Middle East, it's bakshish. No matter what you call it, it's smart business. I'm Zina Fobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second-largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the FLOC, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like, a merger of some of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
13 million. Who will give me 14? I have 14 million. Do I hear 15? 15, 16. There to you, sir.
Political power doesn't come cheap in America.
Sold for $22 million. Another rollback in air quality regulations.
George Bush understands that money equals power. His campaign spent nearly $50 million this March alone. That's a record.
Next on the block, the First Amendment. Who will give me 1 million?
Just because it's a democracy doesn't mean it's free. How much is your vote worth?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Excellent news, Americans. A new way to lie. In a nation that's gone from simple childhood fibs of my dog ate my homework to the more nefarious lies of a White House that has sent hundreds of people to die in Iraq on the false claims that Saddam Hussein was about to hit us with weapons of mass destruction, now we have new technology to extend the culture of lying to anyone with a cell phone. Yes, cell phones not only allow you to make calls or even take photographs, but also to join cells of cell phone liars who will help you cheat on your spouse, skip work, or you name it. Take the Alibi and Excuse Club, a network of some 3,400 subscribers, unknown to each other, who are willing to lie for you in exchange for you lying for them when they're in a pinch. Say you want to slip away for a weekend with a lover. What to tell your spouse? No problem. Just send out a message to the Alibi and Excuse group, and you're likely to get a volunteer who will call your spouse, posing as one of your bosses and explaining that you've been dispatched on an emergency sales mission to New York or Paris or Kalamazoo. You pay a fee to join the club, and you're also under some general obligation to return the favor when other members put out the call for a credible lie. Jumping on an entrepreneurial opportunity, others have found ways to add value to the lying phone schemes. For $2.99, for example, you can equip your cell phone to play the sounds of a rasping cough to simulate a lung infection while you're sitting on the beach sipping a cool one. You can also get honking horns and a screaming ambulance to simulate a traffic jam, thus explaining why you can't get home while you're actually chilling at a bar and watching the game.
This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, there could be glitches, such as if your spouse joins the same alibi club and takes your call for help in creating a lie so you can have an affair. Ouch.
Hi, my name is Sophie. For 5 years, I lived alone in this big house Joe and I built 35 years ago. Our girls grew up in this house. They visited every couple of weeks, and I loved seeing my grandkids, but most of the time I was on my own. Some days I didn't even go out. I just felt sad. Lonely, I guess. One day my daughter came over and said, "Get your coat, Mom. We're going for a drive." She wouldn't tell me where. When we got to the ASPCA, I got nervous. But once I met little Stevie, everything changed. Stevie's my cat. It's hard to express what a difference little Stevie's made in my life. It's mostly small things, like hearing his ridiculously loud purr. Stevie brought love back into my house. I may have saved his life, I don't know. But I do know that he made mine a lot brighter.
This is Richard Thompson, member of the board of directors of the ASPCA, encouraging you to visit your local animal shelter and adopt a cat.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. A few days ago, we got this CD-ROM in the mail, Hijacking Catastrophe, 9/11 Fear and the Selling of American Empire. I was really looking forward to seeing it because so many people have called into this program and said, "Have you seen this thing? It's incredible." And so last night we watched it, and it was absolutely awesome. I'm sounding like a gushing fan here. It's really an extraordinary documentary about how we've been had. We've been hustled. Yeah, conservative that we had on the last hour who was talking about, everybody thought there were weapons. This movie just lays out how the propaganda machine worked. And I'm really pleased to have with me today Satjahali. Am I pronouncing that right?
Satjahali.
Okay, thank you. And Jeremy Earp, Jeremy is the executive director of the Media Education Foundation. Jerry is the producer, and Satjahali is the executive director. And welcome both of you.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you both with us. How did this movie come about, Jeremy?
Well, we started it about a year ago right now. We did our first interview of about 32, 26 of which made it into the film. And it started out of sheer frustration, seeing over and over again stuff in the alternative press from very smart people who were writing, critiquing, criticizing how the war was unfolding and the policies behind it. But that stuff was not breaking through. Yeah. Into mainstream media, so we wanted to put together a story and a counter-narrative to the official story that was being peddled by both media and by the administration.
Yeah. Sut, you're the...
And it was exactly the same time that, you know, that it was clear that the weapons of mass destruction lies were unraveling at the same time as, you know, the connections of Saddam to Osama bin Laden were clearly shown to be lies. And we wanted to make a film about the real reasons for the war in Iraq and why we're in the mess we're in.
Right, just laying this stuff out. And how are you distributing this thing? How is this getting out to folks?
Well, the main way we're distributing is through our website, hijackingcatastrophe.org. That's where people are buying DVDs. And also, it's playing in theaters across the country. It's playing in New York right now. It's playing in Washington, D.C. It's just been added in L.A. for the end of October and a bunch of other theaters. You can see where it's playing. It's a new theatrical cut of it. We extended it. And you can find out if it's playing in your area by going onto our website, hijackingcatastrophe.org, where we list the screenings.
Great. And
so, I mean, the major way to distribute it is we hope people will take this and really use it in the next 6 weeks in whatever way they can. You know, show it to their friends, show it to their family, show it in their communities, in their churches, anywhere where people are going to gather to talk about this stuff. This is a tool that allows people to really think clearly about, you know, why November the 2nd is so important.
So, Satjahali, you're saying that basically people have a license, as it were, to show this in public, which doesn't
absolutely,
normally.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. We want to get this out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And so if people want to take it and organize screenings themselves, we absolutely encourage that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, well done, and I have to congratulate you both on an absolute masterpiece here. We had in the last hour, we had one of these guys on who's an apologist for the Bush administration, and it's always great fun, you know, to take these guys apart. I mean, it's almost more fun having people on I disagree with than. You know, no offense, but than with whom I agree. But you know, he was making this point. You know, the whole world thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. Everybody knew there were weapons of mass destruction. This is not only you know, a fantasy, and it's a shared fantasy by so many Americans who think that the rest of the world thought that there were weapons of mass destruction. Sud, why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, what the world really thought about what was going on?
I mean, that's the kind of story that's been spun now, is that, oh, well, everyone thought they were weapons of mass destruction, and therefore, you know, it was a mistake that everyone made. But when these lies were being peddled, there were lots of people, I mean, within the country, not just around the world, saying that there were no weapons of mass destruction there. And so this is a lie that's been propagated after the lie to say that, you know, that it was an intelligence failure. You know, this was not an intelligence failure, and that's the most important thing to point out. This was the manipulation of intelligence for a political purpose. And in fact, the rest of the world, there was huge amounts of skepticism about the weapons of mass destruction and about the link of Osama bin Laden with Saddam Hussein, except in America, where the mainstream media were just, you know, lockstep with the administration, and therefore it's not surprising then that most Americans have a view of the world and a view of this war that is absolutely wrong. It's not just like a disagreement. It's absolutely wrong in terms of what the reasons were for the war.
Right. And Tom, and beyond that, the way I deal with that argument is to say, even if there were weapons of mass destruction there, that's not enough. They have to pose a direct threat to the security of the United States, and that's an absurdity by any measure prior to this war. And that's why you had the rhetoric of mushroom clouds and the kind of bleeding of the possibility of finding some weapons programs with their ability to reach our shores. And that's what people believed. That gave it the color of legality going in there. Absent that threat, not just the weapons, but absent that threat, it's an illegal war under international law, plain and simple.
Yeah,
need to start saying that.
As Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, pointed out yesterday. Jeremy, just to expand on that, one of the points, and in fact, Eureka. It's going to take just a second. One of the points that George Bush made, and one of the, you know, the repeatedly, actually, was that there were these unmanned aerial vehicles. We had this because, you know, how are they going to get these things to us? We knew that the missiles that they had were, you know, had a range of 100 kilometers, you know, about 100 miles more or less. And Bush kept talking about, I think this is the clip. Let me just see if this is it.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions.
No, that's not it. Let's see if this is it. Here we go.
Iraq possesses ballistic missiles.
Yeah, here we go.
With a likely range of hundreds of miles.
Hundreds.
Far enough to strike Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and other nations. In a region where more than 135,000 American civilians and service members live and work.
135,000.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
For missions targeting the United States. Now, Jeremy, do you think he believed that when he said that?
I'm not sure what George Bush himself believes. He may have believed what other people were telling him was true around him. It's hard to get inside of his brain, I think. I do think that the people who were writing that stuff for him knew exactly what they were doing, and that's that it wasn't enough to say he had weapons of mass destruction. They had to pose a threat to us, hence all of the references to the space they would cover and linking it to our security, to our troops. They had to do that. They needed that for UN support, which they didn't end up getting. They needed it to be protected under international law, and most of all, they needed it for the American people to go along with this war, because Americans, by and large, don't like the notion of the United States attacking countries preemptively to spread empire. The United States doesn't like the, you know, American people aren't bullies.
Right. We end wars, we don't start them. I mean, that's been our mantra for 228 years, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so this story, how did this story come about, these unmanned aerial vehicles, Jeremy?
I have no clue. I mean, I think it's just.
I saw a clip about it in your movie. There was a little piece in there about unless I'm disremembering or something.
We have the montage in the beginning where we get the best of the sound bites where they say that they have no doubt that these things were there. I believe that came from there was that Colin Powell cartoon drawing thing.
Yeah.
It turned out to be like an ice cream truck or something. I'm not sure, but it's all science fiction stuff. It sounds like a science fiction clip you're playing to me.
Yeah.
In the film, what we do is we talk to someone who actually worked in the Pentagon when this propaganda campaign was being constructed, Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kutkowski.
Yes.
And she says, you know, that in fact, you know, there's been lots of intelligence on Iraq, and they knew a lot of stuff, and none of it pointed towards Saddam having weapons of mass destruction or the ability to deliver them. But I'm no doubt there's a line in there somewhere in the intelligence that was collected that said, you know, he is perhaps trying to develop, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles to develop it, you know, to deliver these things. And what they did with this intelligence was, what Karen Kutkowski calls cherry picked it. And so they took that one phrase, which may have been part of a much broader phrase, and they constructed this, you know, this narrative that painted Iraq out to be really, really dangerous. And it's, again, very interesting. The only people worried about Iraq in the whole world were Americans. The neighbors weren't worried. Turkey wasn't worried. Syria wasn't worried. Iran wasn't worried. Even Saudi Arabia wasn't worried.
Yeah.
And yet the only people who seemed to be absolutely petrified was Americans. And the reason for that was this unbelievable propaganda campaign that was conducted by both the administration and the media to not only convince people that he had weapons of mass destruction, but also to scare the hell out of Americans.
Yeah.
Because short of being scared, Americans would not go along with the kind of illegal preemptive action that they did.
Now, Sajali, you point out in the movie that this isn't just about a president going off the deep end. This isn't just about a bunch of chicken hawks deciding, gee, wouldn't a war be fun? It really wasn't even about let's be a war president because that's going to virtually guarantee a reelection, although I think that there might have been a subtext to that. You know, you look back over the history of the United States, every time we've been at war, whoever was president at the time pretty much got reelected, you know, other than, you know, Eisenhower saying he was going to pull us out of Korea. But it really is about the takeover of the Republican Party by a faction of folks within the Republican Party who aren't even historically Republicans or conservatives, the neocons. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, if you want to go back to when the plans were laid for the, you know, for the invasion of Iraq, you can go back to 1992. 1991, 1992, at the tail end of the first Bush administration,
right.
When Paul Wolfowitz, who is presently, you know, deputy to Rumsfeld in the Department of Defense, he was part of the first Bush administration in the Pentagon. And he wrote a draft of a national security strategy called the Defense Planning Guidance, where he said, essentially, in a world where there is no more Soviet Union, America can become the only superpower. And we can become a superpower forever. And if we can do this, if we use our military might, our unchallenged military might, preemptively, we don't worry about our alliances, we don't worry about international law, that we can actually do whatever we want. And if we do that, then we can control the world through military force. So this was in 1992. And what's really interesting is when this was leaked, it was leaked to the New York Times, everyone thought Wolfowitz was crazy. Everyone, I mean, our European allies did, even people within the Pentagon, leading Democrats. Joseph Biden was essentially speechless when he heard this because it meant this was a revolution in how to think about America's role in the world, this notion of preemption, this notion of unilateral attack of any country. They've been going back a long time, and so they've been percolating this idea. And all through the Clinton years, they were developing it in right-wing think tanks like the Project for the New American Century, where they were writing about this, you know, very, very openly. But even they, you know, even though they wanted to do this, even they knew that what they were planning was so radical that they wouldn't be able to get moderate Republicans to go along with it, let alone the American people, unless, and they wrote this in September of 2000, a full year before September the 11th, unless they said there was a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, which in fact, fortunately for them, Pearl Harbor. We've been talking with Sajali and Jeremy Earp, the folks who helped put together Hijacking Catastrophe, 9/11 Fear and the Selling of American Empire. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today. This is a great movie. You've got to check it out. HijackingCatastrophe.org, right?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When it came time to bilk California out of billions in energy costs, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." When George Bush's campaign needed hundreds of thousands of bundled dollars, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." When Dick Cheney needed help crafting energy policy that was friendlier to corporations, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." And when someone had to keep small Enron investors calm so the big guys could bail out before the stock collapsed, Kenneth Lay said, "Send me." He pioneered new ways to create profits, and now he has to wear an orange jumpsuit and languish in a cell without room service. We can only hope that there's a squash court at that minimum security prison. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here comes the billionaire!
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Have you visited 100fires.com lately? If not, then you're missing out on thousands of books for a better world. Books about how you can make a difference, about the rights of workers, creating more livable communities, and about how we can stop large corporations from destroying our democracy. 100fires.com offers secure ordering, full searchability, gift certificates, and much, much more. That's 100fires.com. Books for a better world.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Your swift boat liars, you would carry. Who risked his life while you withdrew? And now you're putting kids in harm's way.
And welcome back.
Does your conscience bother you? Tell the truth.
I doubt it.
Hey, wall in Alabama.
Yeah, I think it's power for power's sake.
Disappeared into.
Hey, wall in Alabama.
Hey, wall in Alabama. There's no sign of W.
There's there's no sign of W. 24 and a half minutes, 25 minutes before the hour, 10 seconds before anyway. Close enough. Did you see John Kerry on David Letterman last night? Just a little clip here to share with you.
Top 10 Bush tax proposals.
Oh, my God. Here we go.
That's number 10.
No estate tax for families with at least two U.S. presidents.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's yeah.
W-2 form is now W-2 form.
Yeah, it's okay.
Under the simplified tax code, your refund check goes directly to Halliburton.
Yeah, that's the good one, I think. That's, yeah.
The reduced earned income tax credit is so unfair, it just makes me want to tear out my lustrous, finely groomed hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of go downhill from there, you know. But anyway, this is John Kerry last night on David Letterman. Being funny, you know, yeah. And I'm starting to sound like a John Kerry fan. I tell you, if this guy gets elected president, I'm going to be all over him because this country has so many problems, and so many of them are the direct result of conservative Republicans and Democrats. And well. It's just step by step. We in the area of the environment, I have no doubt that John Kerry is going to do the right thing. I mean, there's just no doubt in my mind. He's going to reverse and roll back the insanities of the Bush administration. In the area of labor, I have some concerns, frankly, and I'm going to be in there pushing if John Kerry gets elected. And increasingly, it's looking like he may well. The only polls that are going against him are the what do you call it polls? What do you call it now? Here, I got to share this with you. This is just incredible. But I've lost it. Anyhow, it's the Gallup poll, and the Gallup poll turns out that the Gallup poll is not asking equal numbers. Oh, here it is, right here. It is not asking equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats who they're going to vote for. Now, if you have 10 people, and 6 of them are Republicans and 4 of them are Democrats, for example, these aren't the Gallup numbers, but just for example, and you say, who are you going to vote for? And the 6 Republicans say Bush and the 4 Democrats say Kerry. And then you went out and said, hey, it's Bush over Kerry, 60-40. Wouldn't you think that was a phony poll? Wouldn't you think something was up? Wouldn't you wonder if the head of the polling organization was a donor to the Republicans? Well, the head of the Gallup organization is a donor to the Republican Party. And sure enough, in the September 13 through 15 poll that the Gallup organization did, they polled 40% registered Republicans, 33% registered Democrats, 28% independents. This is their likely voter sample. Their registered voter sample, they polled 38% Republicans, only 33% Democrats, and 30% independents. Now, would that cause you to be surprised if, since they're polling 7% more Republicans in the likely voter poll and 5% more Republicans in the registered voter poll, would that cause you to be surprised that George Bush is coming out ahead in these polls? And might that explain why the Gallup poll is showing Bush ahead and so many of the other polls are not? I'm sorry to sound like a conspiracy nut here, but I'm beginning to become a conspiracy nut. This is just very strange. Very strange. Anyhow, we need to, with regard to Kerry, he's going to do the right thing environmentally. We need to hold his feet to the fire on labor. We got to repeal Taft-Hartley. We've got so much work to do. Tariffs, 29 minutes past the hour.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. Debbie Thompson from Nevada writes, no one in our area thought the fires in California would affect us 300 miles away, but they did. Your fantastic air purifiers kept our home clear of the dust and smoke. They were a real lifesaver. Folks, just how effective is an Orrick Professional Air Purifier? Well, call us at 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200. Try one free for 90 days.
pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
After 2 years of litigation, a federal court ruled last week that Whirlpool was within its rights to deny a Muslim plant employee a few minutes to say his religion's required sunset prayers. Whirlpool has argued that allowing the prayer break for all of its Muslim employees would have been disruptive to plant operations. The suit was brought by Somali-born Ibrahim Farah, who worked at a Laverne, Tennessee plant. His attorneys argued that the plant was rampant with prejudice against Muslims. Whirlpool's attorneys countered that it would not have been possible for the company to allow the more than 40 Muslim employees at the plant to walk off the assembly line for prayers. The jury agreed, saying that they had seen enough evidence that the company had done enough to accommodate the needs of its Muslim employees. A similar lawsuit is set to begin in the same court next week.
In a sweeping agreement covering more than 8,000 farm workers in a federal visa worker program, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee has ended its 5-year boycott of the nation's second largest pickle company, Mount Olive. President of the FLOC, Baldomir Velasquez, says they won the largest union contract in North Carolina's history.
We have a 3-step grievance procedure. We eliminated blacklisting. If they complained about something, they were put on a blacklist and then put in the government computer so the worker could never enter the country again on any kind of visa. And we have a seniority system now where workers are able to apply in order of their seniority and reclaim those jobs the next year. And the union will be overseeing this hiring effort in Mexico during the winter months. Mount Olive agreed to put out a 10% wage increase over the next 3 years. So the agreement stretches from Mexico to Ohio.
Unions, churches, and students mounted a massive pressure campaign, including picketing grocery stores. A company spokesperson said Mount Olive is very relieved the boycott is over.
Japanese baseball players are going for a walk. The players, for the first time in that country's history, decided to strike after negotiations with team officials struck out. Japanese baseball has been suffering from falling attendance and TV ratings, leaving many teams in the red. Management has suggested a plan the players don't like, a merger of some of the 12 teams. The mergers most likely would cause job losses for both the players and support staff. The strike will end all weekend games between now and the end of the season, with weekday games being played as scheduled. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. When it comes to competing with other countries over education, the United States has been skipping class. A new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that the United States still ranks second in the world for citizens with a college education. Norway is number one, but the gap with other countries is shrinking fast. The primary reason cited in the report is that the U.S. education levels have remained stagnant because of massive disparity between rich and poor students. More than 12% of 20 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. do not have a high school diploma.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the People's Republic of Vermont, high up in the Green Mountains, where it's a bright, sunny day as the leaves are actually starting to change color. Autumn is here, or it's arriving. Winter isn't far around the corner. Amazing, isn't it amazing? Life, every day, something new. Every day you wake up breathing is a good one. I am absolutely convinced. George Bush. This is something I find absolutely extraordinary. How the media handles this. I'm gonna share with you. This was published on BuzzFlash. It's by Philip Rivard, BuzzFlash guest contributor. Bush's top 10 domestic policy flip-flops. Let me just share with you the details on these. And then the gotcha, the aha, the holy cow, is what the headlines were in which these were revealed. First, let me just share with you. Number one, Bush opposed extension of unemployment benefits, costing more than 2 million workers. Then he flip-flopped and supported a limited extension, but only for a limited few workers. Okay, number two, Canada Bush opposed providing government assistance to help automakers develop hybrid cars. Now he's flip-flopped and proposed providing money to develop them. Number three, Governor Bush opposed a patient's bill of rights. Then during the 2000 campaign, Bush flip-flopped and said he supported it. Then President Bush flip-flopped again and had his administration fight against it. Number four, Canada Bush said he supported controls on greenhouse gases to fight global warming. Then President Bush flip-flopped and opposed them, supporting only voluntary reductions of gases. Number five, Bush said gay marriage was a state issue. Then he flip-flopped and said we need a constitutional amendment to ban it. Number six, Bush imposed restrictions on steel imports. Then he flip-flopped and removed the restrictions. And I would add, before he put the restrictions on, he had flip-flopped and said he was opposed to tariffs. Number seven, Bush supported continuing the ban on assault weapons. Then he flip-flopped and opposed keeping the ban, or at least behaviorally. Number eight, Bush opposed the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform while it was in Congress. Then he flip-flopped and said he supported it, and then signed it into law. Number nine, Bush supported letting 527 campaign committees run ads. Now he's flip-flopped and says he thinks they should be banned from doing so. And number 10, Bush supported fingerprinting and photographing Mexicans who enter the U.S. Then, after he met with Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, he flip-flopped and said he was against it. So here we have 10 clear, and this, I mean, you know, there's a list of these things out there. There's dozens, you know, 20, 30, 40, you pick your website, right? Here's 10 clear flip-flops. What did the headlines say that reported these? I've just shared with you what the details were, so, you know, we don't need to go back and connect them all. By the way, Tom Hartman here with you. It's 24 minutes before the hour. Our number 1-866-889-8894. And if you'd like to drop into our chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll take you right in there. It's the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. If you have an AOL or CompuServe screen name, just plug that name in and the password, and boom, you're in. If you don't, you can sign up for one. You don't have to give them a credit card or anything like that. They do ask for an email confirmation. That's to keep out spammers and trolls and things. But that's it. It's very simple, very straightforward. So anyhow, I just shared with you these 10 flip-flops. And now I have to read you the headlines of the stories in which these, you know, in different language. I mean, they were outlined in longer stories and things. But here are the headlines. This is how the press deals with George W. Bush. The liberal press deals with George Bush when he flip-flops. The AP, here's a headline. Bush recants, says terror war will be won. Reuters says, changing tack, Bush says terror war winnable. New York Times, in retreat, Bush says U.S. will win war on terrorism. Another New York Times headline, after citing doubt, Bush declares we will win terror war. This is just on one of his flip-flops, right? These are all the ways that it was dealt with. NPR, Bush revises remarks, vows to win terror war. ABC News, Bush now saying we will win terror war. The LA Times, Bush clarifies war remark. The Dallas Morning News, Bush clarifies statement, we will win terror war. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Bush backtracks, says U.S. will win war on terror. Even the People's Daily from China, Bush revises remarks over victory on anti-terror war. It's, did you see the word flip-flop in there anywhere? And yet, Kerry changes his mind, or, you know, things happen, time passes, circumstances change, or even not. I mean, sometimes in many of these so-called Kerry flip-flops, they're going back 28 years for something he said compared to something he's saying now. And very often they're not even flip-flops. They're simply, you know, shades along the spectrum, nuance. Like, you know, he never said he voted for the war. He voted to give the president authorization for the war. In other words, the president needed that to be able to go to the United Nations and say, you know, we got this big stick here, and we're gonna threaten Saddam with this stick if he doesn't comply. And sure enough, he complied. then the president said he didn't comply, but he did. But, you know, anyhow, so now at least Kerry's coming out and saying, you know, I never voted for this war. I voted to authorize the president. It's sort of like saying, you know, if I loan my car to somebody and they go out and rob a liquor store with it, you know, I never authorized them to go rob a liquor store. I just loaned them my car. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Yeah, these flip-flops that they accuse Kerry of are flip-flops because they misstated his position in the first place.
Very often, yeah, very often. I mean, the fact is that there are some issues on which Kerry has changed his mind, as has George Bush. This is a desirable trait in a politician. You want somebody who can learn, grow, and change their mind when circumstances change. You don't want somebody who stubbornly adheres to a misguided policy.
If I realize that I am on the wrong road and getting ready to drive over a cliff, I want to be able to change my mind and go a different way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you and George Bush are wired differently, Roy.
I did want to comment on your guest with the hijacking catastrophe. We had a house party out in the neighborhood probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. What a terrific movie.
Yeah, isn't it? I'm sorry I couldn't put you
wonderful.
On. I know you called while those guys were on.
Yeah, that's fine. We have
this funky phone system here where I can put two people on at one time, but I can't put three on without pushing more buttons than I can figure out how to push.
That's all right. We are doing some movie screenings out in our community center. We're doing Orwell Rolls in His Grave.
Uh-huh.
Then we're going to do Fahrenheit 9/11, the night that it comes out.
Yeah.
And then we're doing Greg Palaces a week or so later.
Yeah.
And we've got probably time for two more before the elections. And again, it's just to help people get educated. Because if they're not aware of the stuff that was going on that they didn't know about.
Put unprecedented, Roy, put unprecedented on your list.
I think, is that Greg's new one?
No, Unprecedented is a movie by Robert Greenwald.
Okay.
And
I just jotted it down.
It's about what happened in 2000 down in Florida. I'm actually in it, you know, but that's not why I'm plugging it. It's a brilliant, horrifying story.
I've heard of it, and there's just so little time. But the reason that I'm just talking about what we're doing is to hopefully motivate some of your listeners to go do the same. You can pick up these things, whether it's out Fox, whether all of these guys have given permission to do nonprofit screenings.
Yeah.
As long as you're not charging admission, have a house party. Get a bunch of neighbors together. Don't even tell them what you're doing if you don't want to. Have a potluck and have them all come over to the house.
Well, I think I'd tell them.
The community center.
I would warn them in advance, I think. You know.
We're inviting, we've got a couple letters going in our little local newspaper inviting ditto heads to come because we want a debate after 9/11.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, if you don't want to spend the money to go see it because you don't want more to make any money, well, come on down to the community center and see it free.
Yeah.
And then tell us the lies that you didn't see after you've seen the movie.
You know, when I was in Michigan last weekend, there was somebody who there was a fellow who showed up for the I was broadcasting live from WTKG, the Grand Rapids affiliate there, and he came up to me and he said, you know, when are you going to start talking about the lies in Michael Moore's movie? And I said, well, you know, if somebody wanted to point them out to me, I would have no problem. But I'm wondering, you know, you seem quite concerned about this issue. Have you seen the movie? And he said, no. Are you kidding? He said, I'm not going to give money to that SOB. And I said, well, you know, here's how you do it. You go to a theater that is playing his movie along with two or three others, and you buy, you know, a ticket for, you know, Passion of the Christ or something. I mean, give the money to Mel Gibson. And then you just walk into the other theater. I mean, you know, odds are they're not going to care. And, you know, I suppose I'm recommending that people break the rules or break the law or something. But in any case, he says, I wouldn't even do that. And I'm like, yeah.
Don't confuse me with facts.
That's right. I mean, I was just, you know, slack-jawed.
I wanted to call in, but I was out of cell phone range. But I was actually able to listen to you all the way out to Grants, New Mexico, Thursday as we were headed for Phoenix.
Oh, that's great. KTRC has got a good signal there.
yeah, it's coming down the valley or something. I don't know how I got it because it's mediocre in Albuquerque, but then when I headed west, it got better. But I love the discussion with the guy that wouldn't give away $1,000 no matter how many lies you pointed out.
Yeah, yeah.
It was beautiful.
That was entertaining. That was entertaining. Roy, thanks for the call.
You bet. Have a great one. And everybody out there, A, get educated, then agitate.
There you go. Educate
and
others.
I'll talk to you later.
Do
take
good,
care.
Roy. Yep, thanks for the call. Jeff in Denver's on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Interesting point in the New York Times today. There is a letter to the editor from a former Navy pilot. And he said, you know, Bush could produce his flight records. Yeah, they have a flight book, a personal flight log they're supposed to keep.
Uh-huh. Jeff, can you speak just a little bit louder?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he could produce his personal flight log. And he says, yeah, that keeps track of the, you know, the date, the aircraft, the mission, the flight time.
Oh, I know. I'm a pilot. I've got one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Bush could produce that and end the controversy.
Well, except that when he went, part of the controversy is about what happened when he went to Alabama. When he went to Alabama, he wasn't flying, so that wouldn't show up in a flight log. But I think, you know, I think the $50,000 reward and the fact that nobody has come forward to claim it, says something, and B, the fact that nobody is talking about the $50,000 reward in the mainstream media says something too. I find that interesting.
Yep, it's all bizarre.
Yeah. Welcome
good luck to all of us.
Well, yes, welcome to the Alice in Wonderland world of electoral politics and corporate media in the United States. Jeff, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you.
Take care.
You too. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Dick Cheney admitted. This is pretty incredible when you think about it. This from the Washington Post. Admitted doing business with Iran and Libya and lied about doing business with Iraq. Seriously. You think, you know, wait, come on, that's strong language. Let me quote the Washington Post, June 23rd, 2001. Quote, during last year's presidential campaign, Richard B. Cheney acknowledged that the oil field supply corporation he headed, Halliburton Company, did business with Libya and Iran through foreign subsidiaries. But he insisted that he had imposed a firm policy against trading with Iraq. Iraq's different, he said. According to oil industry executives, however, and confidential United Nations records, Halliburton held stakes in two firms that signed contracts to sell more than $73 million in oil production equipment and spare parts to Iraq while Cheney was chairman and chief executive officer of the Dallas-based company. Wait, can you imagine if during the Gore-Clinton administration, Al Gore had sold $73 million, you know, before he became vice president? I mean, they went after Bill Clinton. Watergate, or Whitewater, you'll recall, the Whitewater investigation was, did Bill Clinton lose $30,000 in a land deal 30 years earlier that was a shady deal? That he didn't know was a shady deal, but it was, and therefore, let's go after him. Right, the whole McDougal thing. And can you imagine if the vice president, if Al Gore, had done $73 million worth of business with Iraq before he became president and did business with Libya and did business with Iran when it was all banned? Can you imagine how the press and how the cons would deal with this? What right-wing talk radio would be doing? This is just it's incomprehensible to me. The United States had concluded that Iraq, Libya, and Iran supported terrorism, writes The New Yorker on February 16th of this year, and had imposed strict sanctions on them. Yet during Cheney's tenure at Halliburton, the company did business in all three countries. In the case of Iraq, Halliburton legally evaded U.S. sanctions by conducting its oil service business through foreign subsidiaries of a partner firm. With Libya and Iran, Halliburton used its own subsidiaries. Reuters, February 11th of this year. The Treasury Department reopened a 2001 inquiry that, quote, centered on the legality of the business dealings between Iran and a Halliburton subsidiary incorporated in the Cayman Islands, end quote. I'm assuming that would be Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Under Cheney's leadership, the company used loopholes that allowed companies to, quote, get around the sanctions and conduct business through foreign subsidiaries as long as these entities are not run by Americans. Cheney profiting off business with Iran, Libya, and Iraq. I mean, have these guys no shame? 10 minutes before the hour.
This is Vionik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company. What happened when you, Thomas, gave us a plug, the phone started ringing. The first person said, whatever it is that you're selling, I want to buy it. And for the next few hours, the phone rang nonstop. The people who listen to your program are what they call in the business my target audience, people who are conscious and responsible and try to do the right thing and try to think for themselves. I would encourage anyone to advertise on the Thomas Hartmann Show, absolutely, without question, whether that be on the national level or the local level. And you will absolutely get results. The way you can learn more about our imported organically grown wines from France is by calling us. The phone number is 1-888-ECO-WINE, or you can visit our site at www.ecowine.com.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartmann's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the Project for the New American Century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartmann. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Hi, this is Tom Hartmann. It's been said that if you scratch the surface of any issue of social or economic injustice, you'll find the issue of corporate power and corporate personhood. Join me for the facts on September 24th. I'll be speaking in Portland, Oregon at the Unitarian Church on Main Street at 7 p.m. For more information, call Marcia at 503-665-3957. That's 503-665-3957.
Can you imagine a world in which all kids live healthy, safe, productive, and prosperous lives? Well, that world is within our grasp, and there's a way to reach it. It's called Ecolonomics. And to learn more, just pull up DennisWeaverNow.com and learn how to get a free report of our Ecolonomics educational program and how together we can build a world of prosperity without pollution. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com. DennisWeaverNow.com.
A group hopes to persuade the federal government to drain a huge reservoir in Utah. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. When the Glen Canyon Dam was completed in 1966, it created Lake Powell, a vast reservoir stretching 186 miles from the dam in northern Arizona up through southeastern Utah. The project was controversial from the start because it submerged the scenic Glen Canyon, and it's still generating controversy today. A group of activists at the Glen Canyon Institute want to breach the dam, drain the reservoir, and let the Colorado River run free. Chip Ward writes about the effort in his new book, Hope's Horizon. He says the proposal offered in 1996 was first seen as outrageous.
Well, as it turns out, that proposal to drain Lake Powell makes an awful lot of sense. For one thing, Lake Powell traps huge amounts of sediment that have radically transformed the ecosystem downstream in the Grand Canyon. The reservoir drowned at one of the most beautiful canyon systems in the country, probably more beautiful than any national park that we have set aside. And even as a means of storing water, the lake, when it reached its fullest level, was seeing more evaporation off the surface area than water that was coming in.
Lake Powell loses 22 billion cubic feet of water to evaporation each year. Ward says that's become a critical issue.
course, at this point, because of this prolonged drought that we're experiencing in the West, Lake Powell has started to drain itself. It's actually down below half of its capacity at this point, and canyons that we have not seen for 20 years are suddenly reemerging from the lake and are accessible again.
The Glen Canyon proposal faces enormous resistance from Utah politicians as well as marina owners and other economic interests around Lake Powell. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
To lie takes a liar, it's to steal takes a thief. To lie to the whole world takes a liar in chief. He lies and he lies and he lies.
And welcome back.
He lies and he lies and he lies. He must despise all the what fors and whys. The way he lies and he lies and he lies.
Beautiful. And, you know, it'll take time to restore chaos and order, but we will.
Lies and he lies.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. Where did that go? Oh, here it is. Dick Cheney.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and, you know, he would know, of course. It's because he was doing business with Iraq when it was illegal. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, and Keith in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Well, I was listening to you, and I wanted to make a couple of comments. First was, I think you have a really good point about the timing of the bloggers looking at the CBS documents. And I mean, wasn't it like 19 minutes after the show that the first blog came on?
Yeah, it was in the neighborhood of 10 minutes, yeah. And then, and then 3 hours later, this guy, Buckhead in Atlanta, who's the lawyer who wrote the brief that got Clinton disbarred, comes out with paragraphs of detailed, arcane typographic information. I've worked with typesetters for years and years, and I used to run the desktop publishing forum on CompuServe, and I know that that's not stuff they teach you in law school.
Right, yeah.
So anyway.
I mean, plus, when were those documents posted on CBS's website?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure that they ever
were.
Just
look at them on the TV. You couldn't gain that kind of information or insight from a bad video image.
Well, I think it would be difficult. It may be possible, but the speed with which this stuff came out just makes me wonder. You know, did these guys have something to do with the production of these documents?
Yeah, I think it's a valid question. The other point was, you know, my father was a military pilot, and then he went in when he came out, he became a commercial pilot. And if you don't show up for a physical in the military, it's not a small thing. You know, the military spent millions of dollars training you, and if you are not
you're looking at a flight certificate. Yeah, and you're looking at a court martial. I mean, as a civilian pilot, if I don't get a physical, you know, I think what is it every year now? I think for anyhow, whatever it is, because I haven't flown for about 8 years, so I haven't been taking my physicals. But,
right.
So mine is expired. But in the military, that's court martial stuff. Thanks for the call, Keith. We got to move along. End the show here. I appreciate the call, though. Thanks so much. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today. To Ira for engineering, and to the folks in our chat room for showing up. To Shelby for streaming us around the planet, and Ben for getting our archives up, and Mike. And thanks particularly to you for listening. See you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace.
The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For